Good morning, everyone. This is Brandon with the Iowa Healthcare Association. Welcome to our monthly MCO calls sponsored by Right Dose Pharmacy. We have a great partnership with Right Dose, and we love and appreciate their sponsorship of these calls throughout the year 2022. So I wanted to give them a shout out and thank them for making these calls possible. Today at 10:30 here, we're joined by our representatives from Iowa Total Care. And so I just want to check quick and see. I think, Tony, you're online with us today, aren't you?
Yep, I'm here.
Awesome. Before we go into the provider call portion or the question and answer portion here, I'm going to run through some informational letters quick that have been released within the last couple weeks here since our last call. So just quickly, those info letters that I'm going to refer to today was info letter 2326. This one is for skilled nursing facilities and nursing facilities. It's in regards to the calculation of case mix and how they're going to begin calculating case mix going forward. As you know, if you're a nursing facility, your Medicaid case mix is calculated based off of the acuity of the patients in your facility on the last day of the quarter. What this new process will include, and we were a part of this work group with the Department of Human Services and the MCOs towards the middle of last year, is it's going to be switching this process to a day weighted. So what this does is it factors in the acuity of your patients for every single day during that quarter. And so really what it does is it makes it more accurate. You're able to capture individuals in your facility during the middle of a quarter that may have a higher care needs. And then, you know, as they get better or get stronger and their care needs may reduce towards the end, you're not sitting on that lower case mix for them. And the vice or the opposite of that works as well. So, but overall, it's just a more accurate representation of case mix and should be working pretty effectively for you all. Also part of that group, there were a couple other things that were changed or determined. And one of them was in addition to using the day weighted for case mix, it's changing the rates instead of quarterly to semi-annually. You know, we as got some feedback from providers as well as the MCOs, and the state thought that using semi-annual would reduce obviously the number of rate changes that would need to occur by half, obviously, and may make for some smoother claims processing as we have fewer of those changes to go for nursing facilities. And then the last piece of it is it talks about issuing of rates as cost reports are reviewed. And so the thought behind that is the sooner you get your cost report in, the sooner you will know what your rate will be for the coming year. So, or the closest rate setting cycle. So basically trying to incentivize not waiting until the last week or last couple weeks before they are due to get those cost reports in is the thought behind that. So obviously with that, there would still need to be a critical mass of cost reports to be able to determine the overall picture of facility costs, but that's part of this process as well. So that's one. The second one is info letter 2328. This is the HCBS ARPA Recruitment and Retention Grants second update, and it was a release of those funds through a partnership with the MCOs. And so I'm going to not say a whole lot about that and talk. And that was actually one of the questions that were submitted, was how the MCOs are partnering or in getting some of those funds out, and just maybe what you should have been looking for, because they came out, I think, last week. And so I'll pause on that and wait until we get an update or at least some further information on that. And then the third one, info letter 2329, is the second application period for that HCBS ARPA recruitment and retention grant. And so what this is either there weren't a lot of applications, or we still know that there's a lot of providers out there who could benefit from this. And again, this is funds used for recruitment purposes. If you're providing CDAC, I think is the main service here that we're talking about as far as what would be applicable to you all. If you're providing CDAC and you need workers, there's a recruitment piece, or if you have workers, there's a retention piece that allows you to receive some funds to be able to apply towards both of those purposes. I think it's a very great program, and would encourage you, if you did not apply in the first round and you did not receive any funds, to apply in the second round here, which has an application date of April 22nd. Those need to be returned by. So that is, again, info letter 2329. You'd be able to see, you know, how it's calculated, but also see the grant application form, which isn't too bad to complete. So I would encourage your participation in that. That's pretty much the gist of what I have as far as info letters that were released since our last call. I'll turn it to Tony or the Iowa Total Care team and see if you guys have any updates before we go into the questions.
Thank you, Brandon. First, I just wanted to remind providers that we are continually adding more on-demand learning tutorials on our website. I'm going to share the link of that in the chat now. There's lots of good information out there, videos that kind of help explain, you know, how to create, submit authorizations, recurring claim submissions, how to register viewing claims, anything that you think that you might have a need for, I would definitely check that out. Also, if you have any suggestions of things that would be helpful, some kind of how-to videos that we can create, definitely let your provider relations specialist know so we can continually work on adding more helpful content in that area. I also wanted to remind providers, I know that you had sent it out by email to all of the providers, but we did move to a provider engagement model effective April 1st. And so that new map is online, our new provider relations map with your person. We're kind of working a soft handoff on a lot of providers. I know we've had providers reach out and say, who should they work with if they were working with someone in March on an issue? And, you know, the answer is, you know, continue to work with that person and, you know, maybe bring in the new person, or that person will work with the new person. So it's going to be kind of a transition period. You know, if nothing else, just include both of the PR reps on your email communication so that the new one who's taking over has line of sight to where things were at if you are working on something that's been an ongoing issue. But otherwise, yeah, our map is up and available for it. And our goal with this is we are aligning internally with this provider engagement model as well. So our claims team partners are going to be looking at more provider type specific versus, you know, all provider types, that we can kind of look at trends. We can, you know, work on things proactively for provider types as well. So, yeah, let me know if you have any questions about any of those, but those are the two updates that I wanted to share.
Awesome. Thanks, Tony. We'll just go into our questions that we had submitted ahead of time. And the first one is that ARPA recruitment and retention disbursement. Can you talk about that a little bit and maybe how those, I think Paige might have just put them in the chat, but if you could talk about that quick.
Yes, Paige is on, and I think she's going to give us a little update on that.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, Brandon.
Hi, Paige.
How are you?
We're good.
Good. I just put a couple of links in the chat. I know we've had a number of providers who have outreached with questions related to the ARPA funds. And I will admittedly confess that we here at the health plan don't have a lot of information related to the utilization of those funds. However, I do know there are a couple of resources out there that are posted on the DHS website that are intended to give some guidance. So there is a document as well as an FAQ. So I would just encourage folks to utilize those resources. And as you said, Brandon, there are a couple of informational letters that have been posted through IME. And so we're also directing providers to review those informational letters. As you indicated, Brandon, the funds were released. Most of those, I think, have been received. I think we are aware of one provider potentially that is still awaiting the funds. We're working with them. And other than that, I think we're in pretty good shape. Again, encourage providers, if you did not apply for the funding the first go round, please engage in round two. And we'll provide any updates as we receive them from IME on the disbursement of those funds after the second go around. So that is the update that we have related to ARPA, Brandon, but I am certainly open to any questions if there's something else I can answer.
Awesome. Thank you, Paige.
You bet.
So this next question that we have is about the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan and the expansion of benefits to the medically exempt individuals in nursing facilities. And I know that there was also an informational letter that was sent out about that. I want to say maybe early March, maybe end of February, something like that. Kind of discussing what that program, what the changes are, what that means for providers. Can someone with Iowa Total Care, you know, touch on that a little bit and maybe help our providers to understand if they can take these individuals on custodial care still, or now, I guess.
Yeah, I had reached out to our UM and LTSS teams about this and, basically found that nothing has changed for prior authorizations for skilled care. So if a member is medically exempt and they're entering under that ICF, LTC sphere, then no prior authorization is required. It is preferred that they still notify their MCO case manager of the admission so that they're aware and they can get that changed over in the system, but the authorization isn't required. So the skilled care authorizations stay the same though. So, we'll review the clinical eligibility type, make determinations. If there's medically exempt and there's not the 120-day cap for the services, but medical necessity reviews still apply.
Awesome. And so just kind of to, I guess, add a little bit to that, if you aren't aware with that informational letter, it's talking about Iowa Health and Wellness. So obviously, if you're familiar with that program, in order to receive care in a nursing facility, that individual needs to be a skilled level of care. At least that was the initial thought. And that's the way it's been operated, I guess, for the last several years, is that person needed to be a skilled level of care. The recent change is that if that individual who is on Iowa Health and Wellness is medically exempt, or they've gone through that process of becoming medically exempt, they can receive custodial or long-term care in a facility, just like anyone else who's on full Medicaid benefits and meet nursing facility level of care. They would then meet the same, they would have that same opportunity and not need to be what would have been discharged after their skilled stay if they had other placement to go to. So this is a, I guess I call it like an expansion of benefits because that benefit is now there. Obviously with the skilled side, the requirement is that, or not, maybe not the requirement, but I guess what most providers have been paid for when they are skilled is at their Medicaid rate. So then even with their long-term stay, it would also be at the Medicaid rate for those services. So we just wanted to, you know, touch on a little bit, provide a little bit more detail here. I don't know, Tony, if you had anything else that you wanted to add.
I don't think so. And I did see that Michelle, our claims person who's on the call today, did put in the chat that all claims for the Iowa Health and Wellness claims have been paid and haven't been denied. So we haven't really seen any change. Nothing's really changed on our end on those.
Good deal. Awesome. And then the last one that I had that was pre-submitted is it's a home health question. And it says, we're still seeing the L6 denial, the denial about the primary insurer needs, they need EOB from that primary insurer. Again, this is Medicare in most situations, and they do not meet the criteria for homebound status, so Medicare wouldn't pay for those services. They're putting XB on those claims in box 80 for Iowa Total Care, and they're still getting that L6 denial. And then when they try to reprocess them, there's the denials being upheld. So any thoughts or considerations as to the L6 denial issue that we're still kind of having some battles with, and what providers can maybe do to help fix that?
Yeah, this is Michelle from claims. I was wondering if it was just like one particular provider that's seeing that. If they can reach out to their PR rep with some claim examples, I can look into it and see what's causing this issue. I haven't seen any like as a broad thing going on. But yeah, if whoever submitted this question can reach out to their rep, they can get in touch with us in the claims department and we can see what's going on.
Okay. I think it's probably, or it's likely more than just the single provider that's had this. I know we've talked about L6 for a couple calls now, and I guess if there's any providers on here that are still experiencing issues with the L6, if you wouldn't mind making a comment in the chat just to make sure that I'm at least accurate with what I'm relaying as the experience of you all.
I mean, basically, the L6 denial is, you know, the system thinks that the member has another primary insurance. And so I know we have had issues with that. You know, they've put workarounds in our system to, you know, bypass that with the XB, not homebound. This is somebody's CRA. Can you tell me what provider name you're with? Just put that in the chat. But like Michelle said, we haven't really seen a broad global issue with this. I mean, there's been kind of one-off things. So we either need to look at a setup thing for providers or, you know, because as far as we know, the L6 denial has been corrected. Okay, Skyline 7.
And I know with this whole denial process, part of the reason why they're putting the modifier in box 80 is to bypass that denial. And so I'm not sure if it's, I wouldn't call it a one-off, but I don't know if it's whoever's reviewing that. I don't know if what goes in box 80 forces a manual review of the claim. And that person's maybe not processing it properly after that. I guess I'm not positive how that works. I don't know if anyone has any comments on that.
So this is Michelle on claims. So we have a TPL exception list. So if a provider bills one of the codes that, you know, Iowa Total Care should pay as primary, that code will be on that exceptions list. So it shouldn't deny for L6. That's why I want to look specifically at Skyline Center and see what's going on with their claims. And then we'll reach back out to them and I'll let them know.
Okay. I know Skyline, I don't remember if Carrie, if you were the person who indicated that question to me for the call, but obviously you're having the issue as well if it wasn't you. So, okay. I'm going to go to the chat now. I did have one more that came in that I just had sent you a little bit ago, Tony. It was in regards to the authorization requirements for therapy services. And I just got a couple emails just today that have been asking about, or maybe getting authorizations denied because they're submitting therapy as a home health agency. And they're saying that it needs to go through the new NAI partnership with Iowa Total Care. Can either of you talk about that and it doesn't appear that it's applicable to home health agencies. And so just wanting some clarification, if we could.
We actually have Di Petch.
Hi, Brandon.
Go ahead.
Hey, Di.
Thank you. I was going to say, hey, I saw this question, so I wanted to jump on. We did implement NIA for therapy for office and outpatient hospital services. We excluded home health therapy from it because EVV is coming. So that's why the decision was made. So we didn't include that in our configuration because the quote standard implementation does include home health. So we caught it on the config side. We made a brief error where the code checker said that it needs to go to NIA, and that was an error. I thought that we caught all of those because for a day, I think, might have been two, when those therapy auths came in, they were sending the fax that said go to NIA, and that was incorrect. So we tried to go back and find all of them, and I thought we did. So if you haven't had a therapy auth process because it was in that time, either you can send your info to your PR rep or you can resubmit because that was wrong. So we've updated our website, we've retrained the team, and that's not going to happen going forward. And we tried really hard to catch all of the ones that happened, but if somebody still didn't get their auth, so you might have gotten the fax and then later gotten your auth work. But that's what happened. And I apologize for that. And I want to make sure anyone who maybe has a case that we missed, for sure let us know.
Awesome. No, I appreciate that. I did get a couple emails just today about whether they got a call back today saying that it needed to go through NIA. So I guess maybe just follow up and with that. But it sounds like it's been caught and we're trying to not implement that for home health agencies. It's kind of the gist I'm getting here.
Well, and it is not implemented for NIA. So the problem is, and this is how we found it, then, you know, we told the provider because our code checker was incorrect. So my team uses the code checker just like our providers use the code checker, which is nice. We all have this one source of truth, except when that's wrong. So my team called and said, hey, it's an NIA code. And then NIA would say, no, it's not. And that's how we caught it. So we're having daily touch bases with NIA. And so then we tried to go back and grab everything we had. But for sure, if you got in that in between, you can resubmit, or if you faxed it in, you can let your PR rep know or get it to us and I'll make sure it gets looked at. And then it's correct going forward. The code checker, before I saw your question, I'm like, okay, unless something happened and it got broke again, it's correct. And when you, look here, I can see our code check is correct. So the NIA codes have a vendor for the CPT code, and now those all the therapy codes are back just to yes, requiring an auth, and ITC will process them.
Awesome. I know that the notice, the provider alert went out from Iowa Total Care. I'm going to include that in the chat here for anyone who may have an issue. And obviously, if you are having an issue and need to reach back out to your UM individual. I think you could probably provide them with this and it would back up what you're saying and what Diane is also saying here as well. So, okay. And I think that we're gonna go to the chat now. We do have a couple questions in here, I think. I'm glad you're on, Diane, because this first one actually is a prior authorization question. I know that we've talked about this in calls in the past, because this is I'm pretty sure a home health related question. And it's talking about turnaround times for authorizations. What's the expected turnaround? How soon in advance are we asking for providers to submit those auth requests prior to the expiration date? And then what documentation is needed if submitting in a few weeks in advance for those. And I'm thinking this is home health, and I know we've talked specifically about this, so I'm hoping you'll remember that conversation and be able to maybe relay some of that along.
Yes, and I'm like, ooh, I had a cheat sheet, and I don't think I can put my fingers on it really quick. But yeah, so home health, well, all outpatient services, our turnaround time is 14 calendar days. from the date of receipt. And obviously we try to work lower in TAT. That actually is part of why we did the NIA implementation, to try to manage our volume. So hopefully you'll start to see your cases coming back in under 14 days. So that's the turnaround time. We do request, what was the next thing about, I don't see the question in the chat. Maybe you had it emailed. I was trying to keep track of all the questions.
But, it was early on. It was right after Tony's links at the beginning. So.
Oh, okay. So maybe I wasn't in or something. Oh, here. Okay. Send in before expiration date. So for home health, the first four visits do not require off to allow you time to go in, do an assessment, and make a plan of care. So that's why. So just submit the auth request as soon as possible after those things are done, but you'll know the first four visits will be approved, even if the rest of it isn't. So include those first four visits in your total plan of care, because we'll build for all the visits. But no matter what, the first four visits are approved for a start of care. For a research, we do request that you submit it at least 4 days before the end. You can do sooner than that if possible. For research, what we request is the new plan of care. If it's signed, that's all you have to send, but we understand it's very hard to get signatures back in time. So if it's unsigned, then send the previous plan of care that is signed. So that's kind of how we know the provider's involved and aware of the plan of care. So that's your choice for research: new plan of care signed, or new plan of care unsigned and previous plan of care signed.
I think I found that message from you, Diane, that included the existing home health member recertifications and, you know, if there are no changes, if there are changes to services and what you can include. I'm not sure how this is going to paste into the chat, but I'm going to send it just for a reference.
And thanks for the last reminder. If there is a change in the plan of care, the new one, and you don't have it signed from the provider, then we said you could send a visit note or a something from the provider, because saying, you know, now please see this member 5 days a week and add, you know, whatever care you're doing. So if that new plan of care is different, it's still okay if it's unsigned, but include a note that involves the provider for why the change is made. That's the only thing I forgot, I think.
Awesome. Thanks, Diane. I know Iowa Health and Wellness has been addressed, but has MAGI recipients as well, as this falls under the expansion as well. I'm not sure. I'm definitely not an expert in MAGI. I think is how we refer to it. Any thoughts from anyone from Iowa Total Care on that?
I'm not as well either. I think, you know, reaching out to the provider relations rep or, you know, following up with you, that you can send that over to us as a takeaway.
Okay. This next question is assisted living claims related. For code S5125, paying at a rate lower than the published rate of 554, how does Iowa Total Care claims determine what rate to pay? What does the provider have to have in place to receive the correct rate? Is there a continual reconsideration process for claims to get the correct rate for this code?
Yep, so we receive rates from Iowa Medicaid. Some are contract, and then there's some contracted rates. Some are provider specific and some are base rates. We would have to look and see. I put in to see who Sue Miller is associated with, like what the name of the provider is, and we can look into that and see what their rates should be. If we received specific ones from IME, or if they should be getting the public rate.
This is Justin. Just to add to that too, that's the CDAC code. And so the member and the provider should be signing a CDAC agreement as well that would have the rate that they've agreed upon. So that may or may not match what that rate is that they put in the note.
And the 554 is the the max for that code. Just, I wanted to point that out as well.
Yeah. So the CDAC agreement could be up to that, but it, you may be surprised, but it's not always the max. And so really the rate that we, that the provider should bill is for that specific member should be the rate that's on that CDAC agreement that they agree to provide those services to the member for. The other part of this is, in the rare chance, this is one of the assisted living facilities that's billing through EVV. The rate goes through EVV and will come back through EVV. Again, that rate that we would put in there for EVV would be from the CDAC agreement.
Okay. And I do, I mean, I guess I'll make a comment now about if we are under that limit for CDAC, under that maximum amount, it does seem odd for a historical provider to not be receiving that, but then a new provider who comes in and decides to now start providing CDAC, I assume was probably at that number. So I think that's part of the question is what can be done as far as reconsideration of what the contracted amount is for them for that service and how to get to that amount that a new provider may receive.
Right. And again, I think part of it is, that there will be a CDAC agreement done every year and that would have that rate on there. Now, there are various reasons for why they may not bill the max or agree on the max. If they're on a waiver that has a cap, for instance, and they need to use, money for some other services, and so they want to pay the CDAC provider less, that would be one, potential reason they may not want to pay the max for CDAC in that CDAC agreement, but a lot of that would be based on that, and that's done every year. The case manager will facilitate that at the service plan meeting for all those CDAC members.
Okay. And I do think, at least for most of the individuals on this call, it's likely being done on a service that doesn't have a cap on it. So I guess that piece maybe wouldn't be as applicable for this group anyways. The next question I see is from Tiffany, and I think that's been answered or addressed by Michelle in the chat. So I'm going to skip that one here. And I think Carrie's question has also been followed up by Michelle. So thank you for that. I do see the question about for Iowa Health and Wellness expansion, is SNF care required before custodial care is given, or can you admit custodial care directly? The answer to that is you can admit custodial care directly. As long as that person has a medically exempt status prior to coming into the facility, because then that is the indicator as to them being able to receive custodial level of care for their stay. So they would need to have that medically exempt in place. I cannot speak to the MAGI question from earlier. I'm not as familiar with that piece, but the medically exempt, I've done a little bit more talking to DHS about, and that sounds like if that's in place, they can admit custodial. Okay, gonna flip through. Hopefully that, especially on the home health auth question that Diane went through in depth with us, and hopefully the chat that I threw in there makes sense. It looks like it kind of came across okay. So that looks like it's all right in there. This one is on, our team called Iowa Total Care yesterday and was told that the PTOT and speech specific codes are not used for pre-auths, and that therapy would be approved with the CPT code 97116 gate training. Is that correct?
Hi, this is Di. I can take this one. So I'll tell you the current answer and the coming answer. So the way Iowa Total Care authorized therapy is we call them umbrella codes. So codes that aren't used for therapy. And then, so we auth a certain number of visits using this kind of a umbrella code and then the modifiers. And the reason is sometimes you end up working on, you know, the therapy codes are per body part, especially with PT. So it's like, you know, you did two things instead of one thing. We didn't want you to have to call and update the auth every time. So what we do, therapy is auth under 97002 with the GT modifier. OT is 97004 with the GO modifier. And speech is S9152 with the, is it GS? I'm not looking at the form. So anyway, that's correct. So the code that you put there, gait training, is considered part of therapy. And so as long as you bill with the modifier and you had approval for a specific number of visits with that modifier, it will pay correctly. NIA does very similar. Again, we authorize by visits and modifier. So you just have to make sure you're always using the correct modifier when you submit the claim and then submit the actual code you did during that visit.
Awesome. And does this play with the whole, the informational letter that was released? Oh, it was actually back in November, talking about modifiers, GN, GO, and GP for therapy services. That's where this comes from. Does this is applicable to home health agencies? They need to be included?
No.
It's not. Okay.
No. So this is for therapy code or therapy services that are not billed with G code. So therapy provided anywhere except in the home, this is how we handle it. It's all by modifier. But home therapy codes are the G codes, and those continue to use the G code with no change.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks, Di. This might be a follow-up to that. I was told that code 97116 was used, not the codes you just listed as 97116 going to cause an issue. Peyton is referring to home health, right, Peyton? So,
Actually, this one is not for home health. This is outpatient therapy in a hospital.
So outpatient therapy in a hospital, were you given an authorization for a number of visits with a modifier? If you want to send specific examples through your provider rep, let me know. But otherwise, as long as you have an authorization for that type of visit and bill with the modifier, it will pay correctly. The CPT code doesn't really matter in the auth. And did you call, this is an ICC question, right? Not an NIA question?
Correct.
Yes. So I'm not sure where that code came from, but that code does pay under the modifiers. So in fact, I messaged my team who's on the phone and nobody remembers having this conversation, but it's okay as long as you have an approval for that therapy type and bill with the modifier, it will pay correctly.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. All right, so I'm looking through the chat still. This is from Tiffany. It says, and this is in reference to some double payments that have flown through some audits, it sounds like. How will overpayments be addressed? Will Iowa Total Care reprocess the claims from the audit findings and recoup them, and then reprocess and pay those claims at zero? This is talking about co-insurance. So I think the question becomes, if you're in an audit and an overpayment has been determined, what's the avenue for returning those funds? And it sounds like if there's been a double payment, a check may have been cut initially and then it was recouped later on. So I guess how I've been defaulting and maybe whenever I've talked to providers, and I'm not sure if Iowa Total Care agrees with this or not, but I would default to the automatic recoupment of the funds rather than sending in the check, just to alleviate the potential issue of that being taken back two times. If, you know, while it's in transit or waiting to be applied to the account properly, it would kind of eliminate some of that headache potentially from happening. And I see that Michelle also responded there too. So. All right. Well, I will pause and see if any other questions want to come in. I know we still have a little bit of time, but we've had some pretty good discussion and conversation. So I'll pause here and see if there's any other questions. I don't know if I saw Justin might have unmuted himself. Do you have any comments that you want to make, Justin?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you want, I could give a quick EVV update for the home health rollout if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So we have been working with IME and AmeriGroup on getting that home health rollout going. As most of you probably know, it's going to be a little more complicated for the home health side of things, just because it includes waiver services and non-waiver services. And more specifically, the non-waiver services that also have primary insurance other than Medicaid, which kind of complicates things a little bit. So what we've been trying to do is kind of look at a plan where we can try to roll things out kind of in phases, so that we can at least get things going and get some people into the system before the end of the year. And so as of right now, phase one, which will be kind of the first group that we'll be looking at, will be the waiver codes. I don't think there's probably a ton of use. I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but a ton of providers billing the waiver home health codes, but those will act really similarly to the personal care codes because they all have prior auth ahead of time through the service plan and that kind of thing. So it shouldn't be a big deal for us and AmeriGroup and CareBridge to get those things going as far as in the system. But kind of the next phase is when we start to go through some of the other home health codes, there will be some challenges, like I said, with other primary insurance and then also prior auths, because, you know, not all of those home health services are prior auth ahead of the use of the service. And so we're working through that with CareBridge on how can we make sure this works smoothly for the providers, so that you guys don't see a ton of extra work with trying to figure out the prior auth piece of that. So that's kind of where we're starting with that. There was a stakeholder meeting, I think that was last week, yeah, on April 7th. There's gonna be another stakeholder meeting on May 5th. I'm gonna, after I'm done talking, throw that in the chat. I'm sure, Brandon, you've probably already reviewed that IL, but I just wanted to put that in there. And then also, IME, as part of that, if you kind of, you have to read closely on that IL, but towards the last paragraph there, IME is conducting a survey for any of you that do the home health services. They just want to learn a little bit more about kind of the scope of that. And so they want to kind of get your feedback. So I will put the link in there for that survey as well. They're really hoping that everybody could kind of do that so they can, again, just kind of get some information about how many members you serve, where do you provide services, things like that. That they can use as we're thinking about the rest of that implementation for those just straight Medicaid codes. So that's kind of where we are. Like I said, by the end of the year, the waiver service codes will be going probably in a similar timeline to how we did the personal care codes, where we get everything up and running for providers to jump in ahead of time before January 1st to kind of get their feet wet with some of that, get used to the system if they haven't been in it yet, and make sure everything is working there. So that's kind of a quick update, but I would encourage everybody to, if they want to learn more, jump on that May 5th session. IME will be doing a presentation and there'll be some time for a Q&A as well with all of us.
I appreciate the update. Thanks, Justin. Just a couple comments, I guess, would be, I know with the personal care services before, It wasn't a significant, usually, typically not a significant portion of revenue for providers. But as we move into the rest of these potential codes, I know that it has a greater impact if there are any issues for implementation, and there would just be some obvious concern on the provider's behalf if there are hiccups there. So anything that we can do as an association to help in that process and getting our members connected sooner rather than later to make sure that it flows as cleanly as possible, we'd love to participate and help in any way that we can.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think what we'll try to do is just as we get updates, I will jump on this meeting and try to give those updates to you guys and keep you kind of updated. I know there was just an ask about if the home health codes, if they were published yet. I'm trying to look back and see. I know there were some other ILs about that. I will tell you that INE is kind of working with us and CMS about that phased approach. And so that would kind of contain, you know, which codes are coming out when. And so as soon as that is kind of finalized, we will get that out ASAP. But as far as the first rollout, it's going to be the waiver codes. So I don't have those right offhand. I can send you a list if you want, but that's where we would be starting.
All right. Awesome. I did not see any other questions come in, at least while Justin was talking there. So will all phases be implemented by January 2023, I think is the question.
I don't have an exact answer to that because we kind of have to finalize some of the requirements. The goal right now is to have phase one done by January. The states still have, they can ask for a good faith effort if not everything is going to be done by this next January. And so that's something that IME will have to look into about potentially asking for a good faith effort to kind of go beyond that. I think the biggest thing that will affect the rest of the phases will be how we're able to roll it out for providers to get into CareBridge or use their own EVV vendor and be able to work through that prior auth process, because CareBridge will probably need to change a little bit. And so part of the implementation will be how long is it going to take for them to update their system to be able to accommodate kind of the other way of doing things with the home health codes that are not waiver. I didn't really answer your question. I don't have a solid answer. Other than we have to see how long some of that, those changes are going to take.
Well, I know that in the past we've requested good faith effort during past times. And I know one of those reasons that the good faith effort was approved was because of, I think, the onboarding of Iowa Total Care. And so we are obviously in an RFP process right now with the potential onboarding of an additional MCO potential, I'll say. And so it's possible that good faith effort could be granted again. We'll have to see what they think about that. Julie, do you have any additional comments? I know you were on that call too.
Yeah, thanks, Brendan. Justin, just one question for you. It sounds like that due to CareBridge's piece needing to change for prior auth, that it might be a good implementation piece to have a handful of providers that could work through that process once there's one in place before it goes live with all providers. Is there discussion of that, or what would that look like? Because I would think we would want a small group before we put everybody together.
You mean to get in and work through the system?
Just in particular around this prior auth piece, which is not currently a part of CareBridge. It seems like this may be a piece that is going to have potential for issues for providers.
So I think we would love to hear your feedback. what we're trying to kind of work out now is understanding, and I'm not going to speak for AmeriGroup, they're not on the call, but I think some of what they do is similar to what we do as far as the first however many visits don't require prior auth right off the bat. And then we do a prior auth afterwards, and then it includes the first few visits. And I think what we have to work through is how are you going to be able to get into a member and provide that service or document that service through CareBridge without having a prior auth, because right now the prior auth kind of is like, hey, this is your start. You know, the prior auth links the member and the provider together. And so we are going to have to figure out a way to link you to the member without a prior auth, because we won't have that. So I think that's kind of what we're trying to work through. If you guys have some ideas on how that might work, I would say you could send them our way. But that's kind of, I think, the thing that we're trying to work through right now.
Awesome.
Great. Thanks. And yes, I think we would absolutely want to be a part of looking at what that solution might look at, since we're able to gauge with our providers what will and won't work and what has not worked with what we're currently do for the non-skilled side. So I would certainly love to be a part of that, as well as Brandon, I'm sure.
And then I know Justin also mentioned the survey that I attached to that link that I had just included in the chat. And so I know that there's several questions within the survey. It's not too bad when completing it. I wouldn't say there's maybe 10 or so, 10 to 15. But there are questions that may vary depending on the client that you're serving, right? And so since obviously, for home health, if you're traveling, there's questions rather regarding connectivity issues, or if you can use a cell phone, or if you can't use a cell phone, or if you have no connection at all. And so I think when filling that out, I would probably default, this is just my personal opinion, I would default to where you have the most difficulty in providing services, especially if you have an array. So that way we can at least identify where some of those difficulty areas are for connectivity. Because then obviously if you put, you know, now we can get on the internet, we have zero problems for most of your areas, but there are some that you do have issues that wouldn't be reflected in there. And so that's kind of where I would default, I guess, if it forces you to choose one of the two options, that's probably what I would recommend, I suppose. All right. Well, hey, I appreciate all the reps from Iowa Total Care joining us today. Had some great feedback, great answers to questions. And so, as always, we appreciate you guys joining us monthly and taking part in these calls and answering some of our questions. And so, with that, just want to say thanks again to Iowa Total Care. Thanks to our members for submitting the questions, and also to Right Dose Pharmacy for sponsoring our call. So, everyone have a good rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.